Nancy Drew began peeling off her garden gloves as she ran up the porch steps and into the hall to answer the ringing telephone. She picked it up and said, "Hello? Hi, Nancy. This is Helen." Although Helen Corning was nearly 3 years older than Nancy, the two girls were close friends. "Are you tied up on a case?" Helen asked. "No. What's up? A mystery?" "Yes. A haunted house." Nancy sat down in a chair by the telephone. "Tell me more," the 18-year-old detective begged excitedly. "You've heard me speak of my Aunt Rosemary?" Helen began. "Since becoming a widow, she's lived with her mother at Twin Elms, the old family mansion out in Cliffwood. Well, I went to see them yesterday. They said that many strange, mysterious things have been happening there recently. I told them how good you are at solving mysteries, and they'd like you to come out to Twin Elms and help them." Helen paused out of breath. "It certainly sounds intriguing," Nancy replied, her eyes dancing. "If you're not busy, Aunt Rosemary.
You're listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void. I spend a little bit of time at a local bog. It might be considered, geologically or geographically, a pond, as it seems wet enough for a large enough space to so qualify. But the outlying woods are always damp, and there is, in the mid-afternoon, a strong experience of insects. At any rate, the pond or bog itself is quite overgrown and surrounded by a thicket of sharp, tall grasses and leafy weeds, and a kind of weak American bamboo, huge plants of which, 10 feet high, can be plucked from the earth with the slightest tug. In greater orbit around this foliage which encloses the pond, innumerable thin birches crowd to form a strange picket-boned fence, and from a great distance, with a little imagination, it all has the appearance of a very old type of graveyard, like the place death itself would go to die. But pressing through the birchy fence, and with a little arm machete hacking, one can break upon the little deer trail that winds around the pond's periphery, and, forgoing all else, relieve oneself of the world. It is a very primitive and nice little microcosm of frogs and lily pads, and mica-flecked boulders, and insects, as I said, but I have never been troubled by bugs. They do not like my taste, and I do not mind their sound. I don't know what it is about the pond scent. Its odors of hot greenery and poison flowers, both sweet and bitter and warning. But I am reminded of my childhood, or of some other special, long-forgotten place, although I cannot at all remember the specifics. Yet the bookmark is there. I go to the pond now and then and do a few laps and stare down the frogs. I call the pond, or bog, the Linney to myself for some reason. It's a privately held name I have never spoken aloud. And the Linney Pond, despite being a quite real and actual place, a short drive from my home, seems to be an extension of my dreams, a possession imagined, not real. Thus, I was a little surprised one buggy summer afternoon to find another gentleman walking my little deer path. He must have heard my bursting into the inner sanctum, but he continued on his peaceful circuit. I was, of course, a little outraged at the trespassing fact of him, as though arriving home, I'd found some unknown fellow in my bathroom shaving away with my razor kit. But after some careful sponsorship, I remembered that the world was a free world, and that, if I had a philosophy, it would be that anyone might go anywhere, for any reason. The Linney Pond was his. It was mine. It was no one's. It was everyone's. The distance across the pond is about 40 yards at the greatest, and it's very nearly a circle. I waited until he was at a maximal radius from me before stepping onto the path, walking at about his pace in the direction he was moving, all to the purpose that I would not overtake him. We might manage, if it was mutually desired, to peacefully coexist without the neat trick of a conversation. Despite the humid summer air, the man was wearing a strange, heaping coat and fuzzy-looking hat. Around his neck was a dark wool scarf. He came to an unfortunate halt almost immediately upon my starting up. I sighed inwardly. With my next steps, I saw that he'd turned around. I continued, stubbornly resolved to pretend that it was natural for two odd old men strangers, one much overdressed, to walk unencumbered by the other in a little spot of bog that probably hadn't any other human visitors in hundreds of years. As I came closer, I thought a simple nod might suffice, or even a soft hello, as though to give recognition from my side that we two, Henry David Thoreaus, could be welcome to remain deeply invested in the primacy of our timid little atmospheres. But to my dismay, tears could be seen running hotly down his old man's face, his arms splayed out in the beholden position, as though we two old friends must embrace upon the death of one or other of our wives. I stopped on account of his lunatic form. He spoke to me in a thick whisper. "I'm sorry," he said, "but could I have it to myself for just today?" "Could you have what?" I said, a little overloud. I was not keen on matching his dramatic hushing. "The Linny," he said. I had him repeat it. I had heard him right. I searched quickly my mind. Had I ever looked this place up on a map? Perhaps I had once, and in so doing discovered its real name. But then I'd quickly dissolved this context and allowed myself a private calling. "I'm sorry," he said, thinking I was not understanding him. "I mean, the pond here. For some reason, I call it the Linny. I often let you alone, you see." "You let me alone," I said. "Yes, but now I'm dying, you see." I supposed I was too, in general, but I responded with an acknowledging nod. I turned to leave. "Thank you," he said. "My name is Winchester." "Well, sir," I said in parting tones, "I leave the Linny to you and your convalescence. I hope you are free of your ailment soon."
"I will be," he said. "Going into hospital tomorrow."
"Good luck then," I said, turning firmly from him. I walked quickly back. My hands were on the green curtain and I was about to step through the portal when he spoke again.
"Would you," he said, "would you come with?"
I did not respond, but I did not move either.
"To the hospital, with me. I'd like to do a mourner's companion. I'd like a little company."
I had not heard this term in quite some time. I recalled that a mourner's companion was a kind of book of grief that one might read to console oneself upon the death of someone close. His use of the phrase seemed wrong. I believe I would have turned this offer down cold if it were not for the fact that I was myself not feeling so well. Being in one's 70s, one rarely achieves a state of equanimity, but there are degrees. I hadn't been to a doctor in quite some time, and although the hospital was not an ideal maneuver to achieve this end, I thought it wouldn't hurt to move in the general medical direction, and perhaps find out how Winchester came to give our pond the same pet name I had.
"St. James Hospital," he said. "I'm going in at 4. My procedure will be at 8. I'll be up and around the following morning, they tell me, if I make it. Removing things," he said, tapping his chest. "Will you come?"
I didn't want a verbal contract of any kind abiding in the air between us. Yet, my voice slipped out in quiet acquiescence, and I was shocked at how gentle I sounded. "Of course I will," I said. And Winchester came as quick as he could toward me, arms still wide, and I won't say what happened next. I did not make it to St. James the following day. In fact, I had in the night decided on a different course, a reasonable course. I called a local doctor and got myself an afternoon appointment. In the waiting room, I fidgeted with magazines and broke out in a light sweat when, checking for my pulse, I found none. The doctor, who was bland and efficient, asked me to disrobe and lie down. He rolled me about, poked me here and there, stood me up, had me hop on a foot, leaned me left, and leaned me right. "Your heart sounds faint, which isn't necessarily bad," he said. "But the good news is that your lungs are quite clear, which, actually, isn't necessarily good." He was a middle fencer. Anything could go either way at any moment, but he'd be there blameless as anyone. But I was surprised at the report on my lungs, which I thought would be the black boots pulling me down to the ocean bottom. "In fact," he said, "your breathing is so faint I can hardly hear it, which is not necessarily bad." And of course, in the hooking up way the universe moves, I was shortly transported by car to St. James Hospital. It would be a 2-night and possibly 3-night stay for me. Some blood testing, some fasting, some proposed vomiting even. Dyes would be injected, scans would be had. The untouching tools of light and sound would be brought to bear. I glazed over at the nurse's rally cry of all the components and missions that would be launched upon me. I had a private room. I was lucky, they said. I folded my clothes and tucked them in the closet and lay on the bed in my little onesie. I had heard stories about the indiscretions of the hospital outfit, but I found mine to be quite covering. Later that evening, I strolled out to the halls. I had been too in shock from the numbing charge of my derailed momentum to quite pick up on the place itself. I was more peaceful now, suspended as I was, having no responsibility to continue a normal life. Firstly, as small as my room was, a child's room, a rich man's closet, the halls were as wide as roads. The ceiling in my room was quite low, but the whole ceiling went up into the rafters. The floors and the walls were comprised of white tile interleaved with black grout, but the tiles were the small square size of dice, and the grout was a good inch across. It gave a very soft feel, as though one might soon sink into the floor or be blended into a wall. At the main station, the duty nurse kindly allowed me to superview her patient chart, and I found that Winchester was being held in the floor above me. I thanked her and crossed toward an open elevator. As the doors opened on 3 and I stepped out, I found myself in a veritable funhouse. Merry finger paintings covered the walls, and in the road-wide halls were scattered tiny chairs and tiny tables covered in colored wood blocks. Either the seating chart of the duty nurse was off, or I had misread it, or, for whatever bizarre reason, Winchester was being kept with children. It was nearing 9 o'clock, and the hall light was dimmed. I could hear televisions here and there and the faint echo of lullabies and children's stories. And I found Winchester in the specified room, alone and unconscious. Because of his fuzzy-hatted, large-coat weepiness, I hadn't got a good glimpse of him at the Linney Pond. But I did now. The surprise was that his grey-white hair was so long. It sprawled out on either side of him, like the hair of a once-attractive woman. His head was large and horsey, as were his hands and feet, and there was a sense of overtaking dark spaces. His open mouth, his great nostrils and sunken eyes, all gathered toward a blackness. His grave features, in fact, were all well summoned up, as though more than the normal amount of effort had gone into the making of his brow, his nose, his sockets. There was a wild grandness about him, as though here was the king of the horses. I did not linger. The following morning, after my quite nice breakfast, I relented having to visit him. The tiny tables and chairs, the colored blocks, all would be engaged with tiny people. I did not want to see these ill children, whom I imagined in a quite unfair way, all bald and veiny-headed, with great blood-touched bandages on their arms, or leaky tourniquets. Perhaps some of them would be laying in the hall, untended and moaning. I was also not interested in encountering that kind of dying child
who has become preternaturally calm. There is nothing more disturbing than a child aware of his imminent demise, who yet is capable of living more vividly than oneself. I decided to wait until evening to go up to see old Winchester. My own testing went along. Not much was found. My heartbeat was faint, and my breathing was still strangely, nearly undetectable. This was apparently the most troubling aspect for the doctors, as despite their leaning the word nearly rather vigorously against the word undetectable, they, in fact, had not detected my breathing at all, except for when I spoke or purposefully engaged in the action. This troubled them well enough that they installed me for a full week and ran out a new gamut of stingily small unpleasant tests, all of which had acronyms that sounded to me like sandwiches, BLTs, EBLs, and TKAs. I visited Winchester that night. He was sitting up in bed, a bowl of uneaten ice cream in the tray before him. "You came," he said in a rasp. He now observed my hospital costume with a squint. "I'm in for some tests, nothing serious. Just not breathing, apparently." Winchester smiled. "Good for you," he said. For a quick moment, he nodded off. Then, eyes closed, he said, "Get a notebook and a pen and come tomorrow, and we'll start with Annie Robbins first. She's the girl in the next room over." He gasped and tightened to one side. There was no real room for questioning. I returned to my room, grabbed a little money, and went down to the gift store to get a notebook and pen so that we might start, how I could not guess, with Annie Robbins.
Inchworm, inchworm, measuring the marigold, you and your arithmetic, you'll probably go far. Inchworm, inchworm, measuring marigold, seems to me you'd stop and say how beautiful they are.
When I returned the following afternoon, I was surprised to find a quiet hall. The bald, bandaged children were not up and about, but Winchester was. He was already outside his door, nearly doubled over in post-surgical stooping, as though his entire midsection had been emptied. When he saw me, he kicked into a high gear
and by the time I arrived, he was already clattering through Annie Robbins' door. "Ready?" he croaked at me. In the distance, a nurse or two moved in and out of rooms with their clipboards, and I worried that it might not be so proper for two old men, partially clad, to go visit a strange sick girl. But I followed him in, remaining near the door, just in case. Winchester hobbled across the room toward the chair near the bed. He sat down and took the hand of the little girl laying quietly there. "Meet Annie," Winchester said. "I have never been comfortable around children. I do not know what language to provide them." I nodded to the worried-looking little girl, her face pressed in a mixture of upset, blankness, and fear. She blinked hard at me. "Are we ready?" Winchester asked. Annie smiled at him and nodded. "Is your favorite color red?" Winchester asked. Annie nodded yes. Out of the side of his mouth, he called, "Write it down, Sherwin." I did. There followed a long series of questions, preferences about this and that, whether she liked rain, the summer, snow, fields, meadows, whether she spent time on trains or ever visited France. After the interview, we returned to Winchester's room. He was quite exhausted, but there was some illumination in his eyes. "Now," he said, "we shall create her mourner's companion. Are you ready?" I sat down at the small visitor's table, provided more to prop up a vase of flowers than be so disposed, and put pen to paper as Winchester started. "Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Annie Robbins. Her favorite color was red, and she lived on the very highest point of Snow Mountain, which, though covered with snow, was quite the nicest, warmest place in the world. Bluebirds sang in the trees, kittens slept in the easy shadows, and there were beautiful small baskets of apples here and there across her mountain field, where daily the beautiful little girl with brown hair and blue eyes went to fly her kite, which she mounted into the breezes higher than any boy had ever done."
Come away, human child, to the water. Come away, human child, to the water and the wild.
Highland of Slotwood and the lake, there lies the leafy island where flapping herons wake the drowsy water rats. There we hid our fairy vats full of berries and the reddest cherries.
Come away, human child, to the water. Come away, human child, to the water and the wild.
The dim grey sands with light, far off by furthest grasses, we footed all the night, weaving olden dances, mingling hands and mingling glances, till the moon has taken flight. To and fro we leap, chasing frothy bubbles, while the world is full of troubles and is anxious in its sleep.
Child, to the water. Come away, human child, to the waters and the wild, with the fairy and the man.
wandering water gushes from the hills above Glencairn, and pools among the rushes that scarce could be the star. We seek for slumbering trout, and whispering in their ears, we give them in quiet dreams. Leaning softly out from ferns that drop their tears over the young streams. Going the solemn eyed, he'll hear no more the lowing of the calves on a warm hillside, or the kettle on the hob sing peace into his breast, or see the brown mice spot around and around. For he comes,
the human child, to the water.
He comes,
the human child, to the water and the wild.
With the fairy hand in hand, from a world more full of weeping.
More testing for me. More interviews with children. More mourners' companion stories were composed. Winchester rarely relied upon my reporter's gathering, although sometimes he would confirm a fact or two. Kevin's favorite food was cheese noodles, is it not? But he was a solid listener, a deep listener. My purpose, as it developed, was to read, to become the reciter of these fairy tales. I would visit Annie Robbins, and then Kevin Stevens, and then Mary Montgomery, and then others. I would sit and read Winchester's story. I cannot describe exactly the children's experience of these stories, only to say that it was my perception that a quiet shift took place with each recitation. The worried little girl with the pressed face became radiant. And rather than finding this preternatural vividness upsetting, as I originally expected, I found myself impatient for a new story to be composed, that I might go off and read it, and share in the space of peace created when story and story hero was so naturally requited. A week went by. Winchester seemed to be getting stronger. I was, unfortunately, from the tests and medications, degrading. The search for my mythological breathing continued. My pulse was fainter than ever. My life signs were sneaking into the cupboards. But, strangely, there was some inner insistence that kept me free of all worry. I will not die, I thought. The children did, however. I had probably read Annie her story 3 times when, arriving at her room, I found it occupied by a different child. It had become my practice to leave the stories with the children, and it was quite striking to find that both Annie and her story were gone, as though they had somehow perished into one another. In the following days, Kevin Stevens and Mary Montgomery and their stories were gone, and it came to be a rhythm. A story was read at most 3 times, usually just twice, before the child would disappear. It so happened that Winchester appeared to relapse. I came up as usual in my growing state of distress and found him not wandering the halls or playing with the children, but in bed under heavy cover. His rasp had returned. I sat down and without a thought began to interview him. His favorite color, like mine, was green. He very much liked animal crackers, fierce storms and raging seas, and long trips over dark country in empty trains. After the interview, I sat for an hour or so, composing his tale. Where Winchester's stories were strictly of the fairy tale world, personalized to the child's likes and dreams, but always involving sleeping princes and princesses, or transfiguring or otherwise cursed frogs, my fable for Winchester, perhaps because of its striking adult content, turned into a dreamy adventure that, when I was done, I thought he might find upsetting for its lack of conventional form, at least as far as he'd displayed it. Unfortunately, the composition and interview had brought me to my limit, but I promised Winchester that I would return the following day to read his mourner's companion to him. I began to struggle up from my chair, but found that my body had become unbearably heavy. To my astonishment, Winchester leapt from his bed, making some rapid recovery. He took my arm, gripped my middle, and with surprising strength took much of my weight. We walked together in this clutch all the way to my room. Winchester laid me into bed, held water to my lips. I closed my eyes, seeing stars and flashings, and in my ear a type of fuzzy electronic hum going in and out. I tossed and turned against these oncomers. Winchester added his voice to the room, and I concentrated on it. I could not make out the words, but I found that I could hold on to the sound, as a man at sea might hold on to a floating board. I turned from the flashing lights, from the crackling hum in my ear, and I listened. His voice had become a cool stream, murmuring, settling, quieting, and I realized after a time that he was reciting his own just-written story, his own mourner's companion, and that his favorite color green was mine, and that his favorite experience was mine, that we'd both named our pond the Linney. Our mourner's companion was the same. Darkness in the eyes as peace grew wide into the room as I listened to the story I'd written for him, that he'd written for me, for us both then forever, the deepest groove of dream life. Over the dark mountains Sherwin moved, stepping lightly, mountain by mountain, head pressing up into the cloud banks, lightning cracking glass over his shoulders, but a warm and pleasant tickle and thunder like a child's sigh. Ahead the sky is evening blue, and the sun burns 2 great girders in the earth, a gleaming highway, the railway tracks. And he's sitting up front, pressing his foot on the pedal. A little more, gliding over the bright dark countryside in the long empty train. Until just so, he removes his foot, and the train continues onward, its great momentum flagging, and just the right amount, he thinks, for a final visit round. He exits the engine car, and slowly, and with pleasure, walks through his familiar train, the coach, the diner, the observation cars, occasionally sitting to gaze out at the countryside, at the passing fields and forests. In the dining car, he has a glass of wine, a cheese sandwich. The train slows. At the back of the train, he stands in the open air. The tracks quicksilver the distance, and the air is dry and cool, and the smell is of coal dust and sweet leaves. From his pocket he grabs a silk bag. He empties its contents into his hand. Diamonds, rubies, emeralds, each one familiar, each one precious, and he drops them, one by one, into the runaway world. The train struggles now, nearing its stop, and Sherwin heads back toward the front. Sitting at the controls, he wraps a warm blanket around his shoulders, places the engineer's cap on his head. On the dash before him is a box of cookies. He opens this as the train pushes ever so slightly into the ocean and comes to its halt. The sky darkens again. Rain thrashes the white-cut waves. But Sherwin is quite safe here, quite as happy as he can be, with his animal crackers, warm shoulder blanket, in his train, in the rain, by the sea.
I died of death, laying inertly on my bed, pillows soaked by my dripping sweat, cold frozen sand of my chest, wallpapers bone at the bend, timber floor plank. She climbs the ladder, picking fresh fruit for today's market. I think as I eat an orange, that should be. Oh, so dry. Oh, eat my shoe. After walking all those.
But I did not die, although something did. Somehow, in the riddle of my mourner's companion, my fear of death was dissolved. Death had, in this administration died. On the day of my release, I went up to visit Winchester, but he was gone. I approached the duty nurse to commiserate, a woman I had become somewhat friendly. "Mr. Winchester has died," I said. She squinted at me. "No," she said. "Mr. Winchester lived. He departed a few hours ago." And as it turned out, the third floor was a tonsils and adenoid wing. It may always be the funny little joke of the world that no one else is dying, just oneself. Been listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.